On today's episode, we are diving into the latest running research. Welcome to the podcast helping you train, rehab, and run smarter. When I first started running in my 20s, I knew it would be something I'd be passionate about for the rest of my life. But unfortunately, developing injury after injury disrupted my progress and left me undertrained at the start line on race day. Even with my knowledge as a physio, I still fell victim to the vicious injury cycle, and when searching for answers, struggled to decipher between common running myths and evidence-based guidance. That's what this podcast is here to help you with. So join me as a Run Smarter scholar, and let's break the injury cycle by raising your running IQ and achieving running feats you never thought possible. Welcome back, Run Smarter Scholars. I hope your training is going well this week. My training's been going okay. I think I've mentioned once or twice that I have a HYROX event coming up. It is just 9 weeks away, but I've been training for the last 4 or 5 months for this particular occasion. If you're not familiar, it is a 1K run that's in between 8 different workout sessions. So we're talking ski erg, we're talking sled push, sled pull, rower, farmer's carry, lunges, wall balls. I always tend to miss one. Oh, broad-based burpees. Everyone does the same weight, the same distance, the same reps. And unless you're a pro, the pro version, it's a little bit heavier, but exciting and terrifying at the same time is how I like to describe it. My training itself has had a slight hiccup the last week or two. I've had my hip flexor be a little bit irritated. It was during hill sprints. I'm pretty sure that that's what really caused it. And this isn't something that is too foreign for me. I've had this hip flexor issue pop up every now and then for a while. And I even did a YouTube video about it, working on rehabbing it, which at the time I rehabbed it fine. Was months and months before it even emerged again. And the hill sprints themselves wasn't too abrupt. Might have been getting stronger, might have been getting faster. I usually do 2 or 3 hill sprints, same hill, same, effort every time. But this one was, I did 3 and it seemed like I was going a little bit faster, and then it was just irritated for the subsequent days. But what's interesting is, like, once it's irritated, it's always irritated by things like hip flexion. Last time, as I mentioned in the YouTube video, it was box jumps, because you have to really dynamically use your hip flexors to lift your legs up, to lift your knees up, to clear the box. And I did too many of them, and that's what stirred it up last time. But then once it is irritated, it's like deep squats and things like that that irritate it. So that carried over into my rowing, my lunges, my broad-based burpees, my wall balls, like those sorts of things were being impacted by this irritated hip that I now have. So my training has had to be slightly modified here and there. I'm constantly trying to work out what I can, where my adaptation zone is. I tried a slightly faster, I did a 6K run a few days ago with, like, alternating like a slow, easy run and then a moderate run, or a slow K, moderate K on repeat. That tended to irritate it a little bit. But then I did a workout again with modifications. I did a ski erg. I did this yesterday, ski erg, then a some burpees, but did burpees with a really wide base. So, like, my feet were really wide, so I didn't have to go into like a pinchy sort of position. I should mention as well, I've got this hip impingement on the right side. So whether that has something to do with it, whether my hip flexors get irritated and then my impingement tends to further irritate, I'm not entirely sure. But I did my burpees, then I did the rower, which I modified the row so that I'm not reaching too far forward. So I'm actually limiting my power, but not reaching so that it pinches my hip too much. And then I did wall balls, which weren't full depth because mainly the wall balls, my limitation is my shoulders get super fatigued when I do these wall balls. So that's my main limitation. So I'm like, let me do the ski erg, the burpees with modifications, the rower and the wall balls with modifications. I did 3 rounds of those yesterday and I felt fine. So just constantly playing around with how I can modify, but still, even to still work on my weak links. So I was quite happy about that. And then I did a really slow 12K run today and seems to be fine. So constantly diving into it, but really enjoying the training. I bought a sled, a secondhand sled off Facebook Marketplace, and then I need to get a rope to pull it. But I'm just going to be pushing and pulling up and down my garage, which is like 11, 12 meters long. It's a very long garage. So looking forward to incorporating that into my training and trying to mimic race day event conditions as much as possible. I've even, like, in the last 4 or 5 months built up to getting like to race weight, you could say. The walking lunges is 100 meters, but you have to lift 20 kilos. So I've actually built that up, and I've built up to 20 kilos, and now I'm actually going beyond that. So like once a week, I'm alternating weeks. So one weekend I'll do a sort of a modified schedule at race weight, and then the next week I'll actually go higher than or heavier than race weight, and then sort of alternate between the two. So really enjoying that. And yeah, like I say, hopefully your training is going well. I've got a couple of running research articles that have popped up in the past month and sort of saved the ones I think are more noteworthy. The ones that are really interesting, I'm sort of reaching out to the authors to come on as guests. The ones that aren't really that interesting, which there are plenty, I just move to the side. And then there are some that I think will be great for YouTube, so I've decided to give them their own separate little category. But the first one that drew my attention was one talking about running related tech, which they used as, like, you know, any sort of monitoring device, any sort of watch, smartwatch, Strava, chest strap, anything to sort of monitor your running. And the title of the paper was Exploring the Relationship Between Running Related Technology Use and Running Related Injuries, a cross-sectional study of recreational and elite long distance runners. And so what they did was just do a cross-sectional online survey where they looked at 282 adult runners, cross-sectional meaning like looking at elites, looking at just recreational runners, seeing if there's any differences between the two. And they concluded that in our survey, 37% reported a running-related injury in the past year. And they mentioned that this is slightly lower than what has been noted and been done in previous studies. They said slightly lower because previous studies say that, you know, 40 to 50% of runners are injured in a given year. So this particular cohort didn't get as many injuries or didn't report as many injuries, because maybe the definition of running related injuries is slightly different in this study compared to other studies, or maybe because it's an online survey, people sort of convince themselves that they're not injured. Whereas if you talk to or get them assessed by a health professional, they'd probably say you're injured. Nonetheless, they said, this isn't that important, but I thought it might be worth mentioning. The most commonly affected body parts were the knee. So the knee is the most, research will show, it's the most common area, location, joint to be susceptible to injuries in running. So 12.5% reported injuries at the knee. The foot was the second most with almost 10%. And then they just had the lower leg, which I guess is any other part of the lower leg, maybe the calf and shin area would be classified as the lower leg. That was at 6.5%. And they said this was, in terms of the areas that is consistent with other similar studies. Okay, what other useful information did they find? They found that elites were less likely to get injured compared to recreational runners. And this corresponds with prior data noting that recreational running behavior is a risk factor for running related injuries. So when they say recreational running behavior, maybe that is doing too much too soon. Maybe that is just not knowing their capabilities and listing that as a risk factor for injuries. Additionally, Injury prevalence was found to rise with the distance of the event individuals were training for, aligning with the widely accepted principle linking higher training volumes to increased risks of injuries among runners. So if someone was training for a half marathon, they're less likely to get injured compared to those training for a marathon. If you're training for an ultra, more likely to get injured than if you're training for a marathon. So the longer the distance of the event that you're training for, the higher the risk of injury. I don't think that's a major revelation, wouldn't be a surprise to many people, but it's probably worth mentioning, because if you just go from training for a 10K, then a half marathon, and then you decide to give a marathon a go, just know that by default, your risk of injury is a lot higher. And so you should put all some safeguards in place, maybe be a little bit patient, maybe not be as reckless as you might have been, maybe not take as many risky behaviors as you did training for that half marathon, because if you treat it in the same manner, you know, the risk of injury increases. They say those who used running-related technology were more likely to be injured than those who were not using running-related technology. So that's interesting in itself. Part of me thinks there might be a few reasons here, but the paper said that running-related technology use can predispose a runner to a higher likelihood of injuries, particularly in the case of recreational and inexperienced runners. Based on metrics provided by this technology, recreational and inexperienced runners may acutely increase their training loads. They found in previous studies that the highest portion of runners utilizing this tech were individual competitive recreational runners. So those who aren't in a team, competitive, so I guess trying to push out their best performance, trying to beat their best self, or trying to, you know, do as best as possible. Recreational runners, individual, competitive, recreational runners. So recreational meaning, you know, you're not for a team, you don't have a coach, you're just out there doing it. And they say that the individual, competitive, recreational runners are thus at high risk of injury, as they lack the professional coaching to safely increase their training loads and are intrinsically driven to ramp up their training speeds and distances. So they have that motivation to try and do their best, but without that guidance. But they have the tech, but maybe that tech provides more drive and likely to, you know, cause or increase that risk of injury. The paper says, furthermore, these negative behaviors can be worsened in this population by fostering obsessive tendencies, leading to increased anxiety and the formation of exercise addiction patterns. This particular phrase was interesting because, you know, I work with runners a lot, and I know that a lot of runners self-confess of having some obsessive tendencies. And if you were injured tomorrow and you couldn't run, do you reckon you get a bit antsy? Do you reckon you have a little bit of anxiety? If there is a race coming up, do you think there might be a bit of anxiety there? I've seen runners be injured and just run through pain. They don't want to take time off. They, to their own detriment, they will refuse to stop running and keep running anyway. I think that's a slight definition, not a definition. I guess that's a slight kind of pattern for exercise addiction. So, you know, I think this calls for a fair bit of self-reflection here. The paper says many fitness apps are designed to capitalize on peer pressure, encouraging users to share workout data and receive virtual praise, while also facilitating social comparisons with features such as leaderboards and challenges. Furthermore, the carryover effect of negative emotions such as guilt or disappointment may be heightened, especially amongst inexperienced users of self-tracking apps impacting their decisions relating to activity tracking. Essentially saying, if you are using this tech and you are then using like fitness apps, by design, they want people to engage. They want people to do better. They're sort of promoting physical health. They're promoting you to use the app, leaderboards are very motivating. Challenges are very motivating. We have Strava that has segments, that has leaderboards, that has likes, kudos, all those sorts of things. And then you just share it with your friends and family who are on Strava. And so might come as a, it could be a double-edged sword. Yes, it promotes activity, health, all those sorts of things. I don't think there would be a lot of runners here that don't have the motivation to run if they didn't have that particular outlet, whereas it also can foster these other tendencies to overpush, to if it's too slow, the guilt and disappointment if you're not running because you're injured and you can't post, all these things. That's sort of the conclusion of the paper. Those who are individual competitive recreational runners likely to get injured, especially if you're preparing for a race that is of greater distance, particularly if you're using this tech. If this tech is pushing these peer pressures, encouraging you to continue pushing on, and you don't have a coach to sort of pull the reins back and say, these are the guidelines we need to follow, the risk of injury is quite high. So my advice would say, let's self-reflect. Are these apps and this tech that you're using really serving you? Should we be very selective of when and how we use this tech? Is it useful for you physically in training? So you might be able to measure your distance, your pace, your weekly mileage, building upon week by week. Is it really helping you physically? Is it really serving you mentally? How are you feeling when you use these apps, or when you look at your tech, or when you look at your data? Do you get anxious? If you see a little drop in your performance, how do you feel? We really should be analyzing whether this is actually serving you, whether it's actually serving a purpose, whether it's actually beneficial, or whether it's not serving you, because you do have the option of not using this tech. Might sound crazy, but it is an option. And I know a lot of runners like data, like sheets, spreadsheets, and all those sorts of things, but a lot of runners get injured, and a lot of runners are very upset when they're injured, and they're very happy when they're not injured. So maybe we need to have a really good self-reflection to say, is this really serving me? Because it might serve you for like just one run of the week, might serve you just when you have to do your interval sessions, might serve you just when you have to do your long runs, and then your easy midweek runs, hey, let's just not wear any tech and just run to feel and just have a good time and take it really easy, knowing that you don't have to post this afterwards. It could be as slow as you want. It could be as short as you want. Those sorts of things are definitely advantageous to people. And then also, like, at what stage of the training cycle are you in? Like, it might serve you in the off season. It might serve you in the peak weeks. It might serve you during the taper, monitoring your heart rate or your effort levels, or monitoring your distances and those sorts of things. But like I say, self-reflect and maybe pick your battles. See when it is more serving you and then more of a disservice in certain training cycles. You can list additional help. If you don't want to get rid of the tech and you like the tech but you think it's not really serving you, enlist some help. Get a coach, get a training plan, get someone to, you know, pull on those reins and give you guidelines. That might be a good option for you. And maybe just through trial and error, maybe just take a break from tech. Maybe just assign your training loads and assign your distances and your effort levels for this certain run. And then when you get out there, don't record anything. That see how that goes for a few weeks, and then see if you feel better, see if you mentally feel better, if you physically feel better. I have been going a long time without recording. I know what a 5K loop is around my house. I know to the dot exactly what 5Ks is, where I need to run to and from. And I know which effort I need to run with. It's usually a 3 out of 10 effort. And I'll just do that. I don't need tech to tell me how fast I need to go or how far I need to run. And for a very, very long time, I just didn't record anything. I've only just started recording my distances, because my distances change. Like, I don't know what a 12K run is. that I did today. So I had to take my watch, and I was very curious about some metrics of mine. I have been using a power device, which I'll be talking about on YouTube shortly. I have been playing around with heart rate just because I wanted to get a look at heart rate zones. I wanted to look at this phenomenon of cardiac drift. So I took my heart rate strap just for curiosity purposes, but I very rarely use the heart rate during my runs. If I was doing like interval sessions, I'd like to use my watch to see like what 1K splits I'm doing. But I pick my battles, and I don't like, it uploads to Strava automatically when I just sync it to my phone, but I don't ever open up Strava. It's not something that I've ever done. Maybe when I first was a runner, I was a bit curious about Strava and that sort of got me motivated. But these days, it's been years since I've really actually opened it and seen who's on it, who follows me, who I follow, that sort of stuff. I'd have no idea. You know, maybe it's worth, especially if you've been injured several times in the past 12 months, maybe it's worth reconsidering your tactics. Okay, the next, just quickly chiming in here to let you scholars know, I have just updated my 5-day injury prevention challenge. This is one email per day for 5 days, learning new concepts and diving into the science on how you can reduce your risk of injury. The sign-up link is in the show notes, so fill in your details and I'll be waiting for you in email number one tomorrow. Paper that I have, the title is Risk Factors Associated with a History of Iliotibial Band ITB Syndrome in Distance Runners. Not really going to dive into this paper. There was some like really peculiar findings, so I thought I'd share it, but essentially they were looking for risk factors for those, they essentially said, okay, whole bunch of people who has had ITB syndrome in the past, and then they just had a look at how they run, had a look at some data, and then tried to find some associations. They found the gender, so female was higher risk, younger runners were higher risk, fewer years of running, higher risk, and slower running speed, also higher risk. So I guess if you're running a bit faster, leg is a little bit more stiff, a little bit more springy, so maybe less knee bend when you hit the ground. So maybe that's associated with that. They did find two novel independent risk factors associated with ITB, which you're going to ask why. I couldn't find the full paper, so it was hard for me to comment on this. But they found an increased number of chronic diseases. If you have a chronic disease, the more chronic diseases you had an increased risk of ITB syndrome, and also a history of allergies. If you had a history of allergies, it also increases your risk of ITB syndrome. And they said that identifying athletes at a higher risk of ITB syndrome can guide healthcare professionals in preventing and rehabbing efforts. I think it's more worth noting more of the gender, the age, the years of running, the speed. I thought that was somewhat interesting. The next one that came onto my desk was titled A Preliminary Exploration of the Regression Equation for Performance in Amateur Half Marathon Runners, a perspective based on respiratory muscle function. I think I need to break that down. Some of these titles are just very lengthy, very wordy, and then I read the title, I'm like, I don't even know what that's about. Essentially what they're trying to do is prior to a marathon, they are doing some preliminary data where they're looking at someone's respiratory muscle function, i.e. how hard their lungs can push air out or suck air in. They use devices to actually measure how much, what pressure you can push the air out and what pressure you can suck the air in, and seeing if that has any correlation with how they actually perform their marathon. And so I'll probably repeat myself here, but they say that the aim of the study was to establish a preliminary predictive model to provide insights into training and health management for runners. The study found that respiratory muscle training can delay muscle fatigue and improve athletic performance. Essentially, like, you might not think about it this way, but like when you breathe, when you inhale, you've got lung muscles that actually expand the rib cage. It's not this like passive, oh, let me just push air in and everything just opens up. There's muscles that actually open you up to then increase the amount or decrease the amount of atmospheric pressure to then air getting sucked in. And then when you exhale, you have those muscles contract and push air out or reduce the space within the lungs, therefore increasing the atmospheric pressure, and then air gets pushed out. So those lungs, those lung muscles are subject to fatigue. And when they are fatigued, research has shown that you can't suck air in as well or push air out as well. And therefore, like it's detrimental to performance. And so studies have sort of reverse engineered that and shown that if you train your respiratory muscles and get them stronger, it actually delays muscle fatigue and improves athletic performance. So they say that evaluating the level of respiratory muscle capacity in marathon runners is crucial to defining the potential speed limitations and achieving optimal performance. They found a correlation here with a particular equation being like, okay, if you are this good, if your lungs are trained this well, this is your potential. This is your speed potential. And it's really interesting stuff. And I have a device myself that I've been sent 3 or 4 days ago just because I was really interested in this. And I'm going to do a YouTube video where I'm trying this device out myself. Apparently, you can get stronger in 6 weeks. Your lungs can get stronger, I should say, and therefore it carries over into performance. So I'm going to test this out myself. I haven't started yet. I want to get some good baseline measures and then do a YouTube video on it. But soon I'll be getting James Fletcher, who is a physio, but works a lot with Olympians, works a lot with high-end athletes. He works a lot with like diving, like deep sea diving, holding your breath. And anyway, works with breath work, works with improving your lung function. So I'm going to get him on the podcast to have a deeper dive, what practically you can do to help improve your lung function. So stay tuned for that. Speaking of future episodes, another paper came onto my desk that was titled Mind to Move, Differences in Running Biomechanics Between Sensing and Intuition Shod Runners. Again, what does that mean? I'm going to get one of the authors of this paper to come onto the podcast because their theory hypothesis was really interesting. The paper said, delving into the complexities of embodied cognition unveils the intertwined influence of mind, body, and environment. The connection of physical activity with cognition sparks a hypothesis linking motion and personality traits. This is a bunch of fancy words. I'll get to this in a second. Well, I'll get to it now. They're essentially saying that different personality traits might get people to think differently, might get people to move differently, might get people to be like different levels of physical activity. The whole mind, body, environment sort of intertwined to one another, essentially saying, can we find if personality traits are linked to biomechanical variables and therefore maybe influence how people are running? I.e., are different personality traits running, are runners running differently compared to their personality traits, essentially is what they're saying. So I found that super, super fascinating in terms of just a hypothesis. Is a certain personality running a certain way compared to another personality that's running a different way? Is this linked to injury? Who knows? We do know that personality traits are linked to injury. We know that perfectionism and perfectionistic concerns, i.e. like, are you worried about your performance? Are you worried about an event? Do things really need to line to place? Do I need to be perfect for this event? If not, you know, bad things will happen. Perfectionistic concerns is really, really linked to your odds of getting injured in the future. There's studies based on that. But is that because they're running differently in terms of their biomechanics, or is it just because they're really pushing themselves to run harder, run faster? But like I say, I've got a interview locked in with one of these authors, and they can just dive into this particular paper and what they've found. Okay, moving on. Another paper was titled Comparison of Muscle Activity of Lower Limbs While Running on Different Treadmills. They wanted to look at different treadmill models and seeing if that influenced different muscle activation. But then they also looked at the treadmills compared to overground. And when they looked at all the different models and say, okay, which different models have different muscle, you know, patterns, muscle activity, they didn't really find too much, or not too much interesting findings. But when looking at treadmills compared to overground, so not having a treadmill, and I am talking about motorized treadmills here, it was a little bit more interesting. So I thought I'd share that. They said, in terms of differences between treadmill and overground running across different speed conditions, muscle activity was greater for the gastrocnemius, meaning the calf, biceps femoris, part of your hamstring, and rectus femoris, meaning part of your quad. So greater muscle activity in all of those muscle groups during overground running relative to treadmill running during the stance phase of the gait cycle. So stance phase, just when your foot is on the ground. So more muscle activity in the quads, hamstrings, and calf when it's hitting the ground or during its stance phase when you are running overground compared to running on a treadmill. They say that one of the reasons these differences might be because the treadmill belt allows the leg to be pulled under the person, or pulled under the person's upper body while they run. Essentially, it is just guiding, the belt itself is just taking the leg along for the ride when it's being passed under your body, rather than when running overground and you have to move yourself forward. You have to put that foot down and use your muscles to sort of have forward momentum. Essentially, the belt's just moving underneath you and you're just trying to lift up your legs to keep up with the pace. And so there's sort of simple to think about, but most people don't really realize it. And so we need to be very careful, particularly if you are treadmill running, if you're doing some, if it's cold and it's winter and you're doing most of your treadmill running, you know, during those winter months, and then all of a sudden it starts warming up and you are getting more outdoors, try not to keep to the same speed, try not to keep to the same weekly volume, because you will have an abrupt shift in those muscle demands. If they've just been on a moving belt and just going along for the ride for 2 months, and then all of a sudden you have to move and try to keep up with the same pace and distance, my guess is the calves might be overloaded, the hamstrings might be overloaded, and the quads might be overloaded. So we do really need to be careful with these particular transitions. And I would consider, if you are running on a treadmill, I advise this most of the time, and I do the same myself, just because when it comes to my HYROX sort of workouts, yes, a lot of running is involved. But the, like, I'll do like a ski erg, and then I'll have to jump on the treadmill and I'll do that for 500 meters and then do a five, like a farmer's carry, then get back onto the treadmill, do 500 meters. The race calls for 1K in between segments, workouts, but I'm not going to go outside and run and then come back inside and do a workout, then run away and then come back. I have been doing that here and there, but it's nice to stay within my gym in certain circumstances. So I do run some with the treadmill these days, and I do use a 1% incline. So I would recommend you do the same, because yes, the belt is moving underneath us, but all of a sudden now we need to push up a little bit. And so your calf, quads, hamstrings, glutes, and that sort of stuff will need to work a little bit harder, which I think there's research to show that 1% incline almost mimics overground running. So that little trick you can also use. We're down to our last paper. I need to go find it because there was certain graphics on that that I needed to pop up. So the title of it was Current and Future Advances in Practice, Tendinopathies of the Hip, like in brackets, tendinopathies of the hip. Now, they talked about proximal hamstring tendinopathy. They talked about referring from the lower back. They talked about those sorts of things. But I really wanted to touch base on the glute medius, or gluteal tendinopathy is what they call it. So the very lateral part, and differentiating that from things like hip osteoarthritis. So I want to dive into that particularly, because it does show some interesting stuff. First of all, let's separate out what is gluteal tendinopathy versus what is hip osteoarthritis, because they occur in the very similar spot. Some overlapping symptoms, I guess you could say. And, you know, when it comes to gluteal tendinopathy, what does the research say is the best cause, or the best course of treatment? Let's start with the area of pain to sort of differentiate the two. It says here, like, in this paper, you can look up the title. It's open source. Feel free to dive into it if you'd like and look at all the other things that they talk about. But there's a good graph showing like where the pain radiates to. But also in written form, it says that the worst pain is over the greater trochanter. So if you were talking about this gluteal tendinopathy, so if you're standing and you feel the side of your hip, not the crest of your hip, but further down, it's sort of like the most or the widest part of your thigh hip area. You'll notice there's a bit of a bony spot there. That's where the worst pain is. But the paper says it may extend down to the lateral thigh, sometimes into the proximal lateral leg. So sort of like following down the ITB, if you're familiar where that is. Let's continue with the gluteal tendinopathy, and I'll talk about the hip OA. The aggravating factors: night pain when side lying. Side lying on that particular side can be quite problematic. Stair climbing, walking uphill or walking with speed. Standing on one leg to dress yourself. Prolonged sitting in a deep chair, if you get lateral hip pain when prolonged sitting. It says pain on rising to stand and walk. Sharp pain directly over the greater trochanter may occur in single leg loading with loading exercises, say during a step up or ascending stairs. Other symptoms may include, well, it says morning stiffness is not a common feature, because it will say later that hip OA is, morning stiffness is a common feature. Back to the gluteal tendinopathy though, it says the hip range usually is within normal limits, so your range of movement isn't affected, although severe pain may result in some guarding. So it's the pain itself that's limiting, but there's no like physical locking up or deficits in that way. Now, differentiating this from hip osteoarthritis, so in terms of the location, this is deep mid-inguinal and or what we call C-sign pain. So if you know where, like you can Google your inguinal line, but it's essentially looking at the your pubic bone, the line that sort of connects your pubic bone to your crest of your hip. And it's sort of like the groin line, I guess you could call it, or the C-sign. So some people say, they come into clinics and say, it's hard to locate, but it just hurts around here. And they get their thumb and index finger, make a C, and they sort of put that around the outside of their hip. Kind of like, you know, how people hold their hips in frustration. They sort of just do that, but you can imagine that just with one side. That's the C sign that they call it. So still on the location, it says the lateral pain, commonly proximal and greater trochanter and below the iliac crest. So a few wide ranges of pain. It says the lateral proximal, or so commonly proximal to the greater trochanter below the iliac crest. So proximal, I guess they're saying higher up, and they say it also may experience deep mid buttock pain and referral into the knee or even as far down as the shin region. So it can radiate further down there. Aggravating factors. Night pain. There's a deep general ache, often referred into the lateral leg. More aggravating factors, deep hip flexion, deep chairs, squatting. So similar to the gluteal tendinopathy, but they do say that this produces that mid-inguinal or C-sign pain, not the greater trochanter pain as it would be with gluteal tendinopathies. Walking distance, walking with larger strides. So this isn't necessarily fast walking or uphill walking like the gluteal tendinopathy. This is more distance walking and taking bigger steps. So not walking faster, but just taking bigger strides. They also say pain when rising to stand or walk. Again, it's more of that C-sign pain rather than the greater trochanter. And they say that there's a sharp, deep catches of the hip. It may happen. It doesn't always, but may. Commonly when doing weight-bearing rotation. They say with hip away, there is morning stiffness. Well, morning stiffness is a common feature. Gradually increasing limitations of hip range of movement. So this is different from the gluteal stuff, the tendinopathy stuff, where it says that there isn't morning stiffness or it's not a common feature and that there is good range of movement unless pain is limiting. But hip OA gradually, like we're talking over months and sometimes years, the range of movement, like to put on socks and shoes, just gets worse and worse and worse. Some overlapping symptoms, but also some definitive differences between the two. They then talk about diagnostic tests, which would be really helpful for therapists. If you are a health professional, maybe check out this because they use what the sensitivity and probability of a certain diagnosis being made if certain clusters of tests are positive versus negative. Really, really helpful stuff. They talk about load management strategies, which is really helpful. So I'll go through those now. I'm moving on to gluteal tendinopathy now. I'm not talking about hip OA. If you have a gluteal tendinopathy, this will be helpful for you. They say reduce the time spent in sustained adduction during standing, sitting, or sleeping. So when we say adduction, we mean the foot or knee coming closer to the midline. So if we use standing as an example, some people like to hang off their hip and it adducts their leg. In sitting, some people like to cross their legs, bringing the leg closer to the midline or crossing the midline. And sleeping, some people like to lie on their side where their top leg falls towards the mattress, again, adducting. So those modifying those in a way and reducing the time spent in these positions could be really helpful. They say at night, try rolling halfway towards the stomach in side lying or lying on your back. And they've got illustrations and photos of this, but if you can imagine lying on your side, then try going to move over onto your stomach, but just getting halfway there and then maybe putting a pillow under the top leg. That can be quite alleviating for some people. They do say avoid hip adduction type stretches. So any stretch of, say, the glutes or the ITB, like some of those people are familiar with, like a pretzel stretch, lying on your back and doing a pretzel stretch, that could adduct the leg. So we want to avoid those type of stretches. Okay, other key advice for activity. This paper says, progressively and gradually increase activity, approximately 10% per week as a starting point. If pain is worse at night after activity, modify that activity until pain settles, then gradually rebuild. Does this sound familiar? Sounds familiar to all the other running-related injuries that are out there. Reduce hill walking until pain settles, then slowly reintroduce. I like how it keeps saying slowly reintroduce because some people can say, oh, okay, I'm done with fast walking, hill walking. That's not a part of my life anymore because I've had this glute tendinopathy. We shouldn't think that way. Should reintroduce it when you're ready. It says reduce stair climbing where able until pain settles, then slowly reintroduce. When climbing stairs, place feet hip width apart, reduce side shift of the pelvis, and you can use a rail on the opposite side of the painful hip. When walking, reduce the stride length, land more softly and reduce walking on a camber. So a side slope, you want to reduce exposing you to that because that can adduct the legs. So that's on the, I guess, the load management side of things. Then they talk about a lot to do with treatments, but I decided just to include a few of the more interesting stuff. So if you do have a glute med tendinopathy, where can we go? Because there's a paper here that shows, compares a few different groups, one being education and exercise, the other being a corticosteroid injection, and the other group being wait and see. They did this LEAP trial where they compared all these different groups. They randomized people into these different groups. They showed that the education and exercise group showed significantly higher success rates than, well, compared to the corticosteroid group and the wait and see groups in both the short term and the long term. So short term being 8 weeks, long term being 52 weeks. The corticosteroid injection group was superior to the wait and see in the short term, but then had no difference in success rates at 52 weeks. So similar to what Miles Murphy was saying in previous studies, when he was talking about the Achilles, the corticosteroid stuff does really, well, not a great job, but does a job at reducing pain levels in the short term. It's a corticosteroid. It should reduce pain, but doesn't really do anything to restore function, restore strength, all that good stuff, which is probably why when it comes to the long term, we don't really see too much difference. Pain intensity was reduced most in the short term by education and exercise. So I guess the education is what I was just explaining about activity modification, changing how you sleep, how you sit, how you stand, and then exercise to build. The last thing that I'll mention is shockwave. So they mentioned shockwave therapy is another treatment for gluteal tendinopathy. Low level evidence exists for pain reduction in the medium term. However, associated pain and bruising often experienced with shockwave therapy and cost of multiple sessions should be considered, like the cost of getting that shockwave. An education and exercise approach should be first-line management with shockwave therapy reserved for refractory cases. I think that is a really good idea. I think let's start with the right education. Let's start with the right exercises because, as research will show, most people get better or it is a more superior method of treatment in the short term for 8 weeks. So I would try it for 8 weeks and see how much improvement you see. If we're not seeing as much improvements as we would hope, maybe we can have this shockwave treatment on the sideline, ready to jump in if needed. Because like we say, it is low level evidence that does exist, but that low level evidence does show that pain can reduce in the medium term. So might be useful for you, keeping in mind that there is associated pain and bruising and obviously the cost. So we need to weigh up the risks. Okay, a lot to dive into. I hope you're enjoying this style of episode. I'll bring you more episodes. And like I say, I've got a couple of interviews lined up that are very research focused. So looking forward to seeing what eventuates there. And I'll be back next month if there's some compelling enough research that jumps into my inbox. If it's compelling enough, I'll bring you another episode just like this next month. But next week, we'll have another episode. I'm not going to, you know, keep you waiting that long. So I'll catch you next week. And as I sign off, remember, every new insight brings you one step closer to your next running breakthrough. If you are struggling to overcome an injury, you can jump on a free 20-minute injury chat with me, which you can book through my calendar in the show notes. While you're in the show notes, elevate your running IQ by jumping onto my free email list so you can receive material to help rehab your injury, lower your injury risk, and increase your performance. If emails aren't for you, consider my Facebook group, Instagram, and YouTube channels. And remember, each insight you get from these resources brings you one step closer to your next running breakthrough.